News. I'm Jim Bertel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says he has survived an assassination attempt involving explosive drones. Mr. Maduro was speaking at a military event in Caracas when the attack occurred. Mr. Maduro has blamed Colombia for the attack, something denied by Bogota as a baseless accusation. Venezuelan authorities say 7 soldiers were injured and several people were later arrested. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has wrapped up his Southeast Asia tour. Before leaving Jakarta, he met with President Joko Widodo, telling him the U.S. values its ties with Indonesia. Pompeo arrived in Jakarta from Singapore and an ASEAN summit, where North Korea dominated conversations. Speaking on Fox News Sunday, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says the U.S. is waiting for North Korea's leader to follow through on his promise to denuclearize.
Our priority is North Korean denuclearization. Kim Jong-un promised South Korean President Moon Jae-in at Panmunjom on April the 27th that he would do it and that he would do it within a year. So the focus here is getting Kim Jong-un to follow through on what he committed to the president.
A strong earthquake on Indonesia's Lombok Island sent people running into the streets Sunday. The trembler, measuring 7.0 on the Richter scale, comes a week after another quake killed 17 people in the area. A tsunami warning was issued in its aftermath, but it was lifted several hours later. NATO's mission in Afghanistan says 3 of its soldiers were killed when a suicide bomber attacked a combined dismounted patrol with local forces. The slain soldiers were from the Czech Republic. An American service member and 2 Afghan National Army soldiers were injured. This is VOA News. U.S. officials say armed men attacked a convoy of cars carrying the U.S. ambassador to Bangladesh in the capital Dhaka on Saturday night. The ambassador and her security team were able to get away unharmed, but 2 cars were damaged. Students clashed with police in Bangladesh during another day of protests. They're calling for better enforcement of traffic safety laws and more protection for pedestrians near schools. The country's prime minister urged students to go home as police fired tear gas during an 8th day of unprecedented protests. The demonstration started in Dhaka after 2 college students were killed by unregulated commuter bus racing to pick up passengers. Farmers in eastern Australia say they are in the grip of the worst drought in memory. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Southeastern Australia is in the grip of a drought worse than many can remember. Last month was the 2nd hottest July on record and the driest since 2002. In some parched areas, storms of dust have forced children to wear protective masks on farms. In the small town of Manila, 460 kilometres north of Sydney, high school students Steve and Olivia say the conditions can be tough.
We wear dust masks in the round yard and everything, in the cattle yards, because it just turns it into powder.
Yeah, it's just powdery. It's like you
can't
breathe.
It'll get all in your lungs and everything,
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has promised to do more to help those under intense financial pressure due to the drought. Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
Swiss police say all 20 people aboard an old-time propeller plane were killed when the aircraft crashed into a mountainside in southeast Switzerland. Officials say 11 men and 9 women were killed, most from Switzerland, but also a couple and their son from Austria. The plane was operated by a Swiss company that offers tours with vintage former Swiss military aircraft. 8 places in Portugal broke local temperature records as a wave of heat from North Africa swept across the Iberian Peninsula. Temperatures peaked at 47 degrees Celsius across much of the peninsula. The World Meteorological Organization says continental Europe's record temperature for this time of year is 48 degrees Celsius. That happened in 1977 in Greece. The Islamic State has executed one of a number of hostages it took last month in multiple attacks on Syria's southern province of Ceuta. More than 200 people, including children, were killed and at least 30 people were kidnapped. Ceuta is mainly made up of members of Syria's Druze sect. They are Muslim, but IS considers them heretics. For all the latest news, visit us at voanews.com. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
When the two of them were together, there have been some issues and accusations of corruption here and there, which the former vice president took the former president to court and took the governor of the day to court to clear his name. And he won all his cases of corruption.
A former president refuses to support his vice president's attempt to become the next Nigerian president.
The late mother was accompanied by some officials of the Equatorial Guinea government and one family member of Jammeh, who is currently living in exile with him. When he arrived, he was arrested and was briefly questioned and was released. He went back to Equatorial Guinea.
The Gambian vice president represents the government at the funeral of former President Yahya Jammeh's mother.
We made an application for refusal of placement on the remand because we are saying the charges, they are not coming out from the safe. The alleged safe took place at the ZANPF head offices. These clients were not there.
And the bail hearings for 22 Zimbabwean opposition activists set for Monday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo says he will not support former Vice President Atiku Abubakar's attempt to become the country's next president. The former Vice President recently declared he would seek the presidential nomination of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, ahead of next year's elections. It is unclear why Obasanjo has refused to support his former Vice President, despite reported attempts by Atiku Abubakar to make peace with him. For analysis, I reach Abdurrahman Balogun, Assistant Editor-in-Chief with the News Agency of Nigeria in the capital, Abuja.
When the two of them were together, there have been some issues and accusations of corruption here and there, which the former vice president took the former president to court and took the governor of the day to court to clear his name. And he won all his cases of corruption. You know, in 2003, he tried to come out. Couldn't make it 2011. Couldn't stay through the primary. That's why I had to defer to the then Action Congress. And now, 2014 again, he joined APC. So, as far as the former president, Olusegun Obasanjo, insisted that under any guise, he's not going to give his support to former vice president Atiku Abubakar. He kept on saying that he is corrupt and that up to now, Atiku Abubakar cannot visit America because they are looking for him there.
But isn't this the case of him choosing Atiku Abubakar to run as his vice president for two consecutive terms, and even speculations were rife that Chief Obasanjo wanted to run for additional terms and Atiku might have prevented that from happening and that created the enmity between the two. Now, these are mere speculations, but what are you hearing on the ground?
Well, the speculation was almost true because indeed, when there was a move to have a third term, Atiku was the ringleader of those pursued that ambition. And to that, former president will never forgive and forget that. Even though former president was still denying that he never had total ambition, but there are indications because our moves to tinker with the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria to allow for a total. That may be one of the reasons that, okay, if you block me from aspiring to getting my own aspiration, then you too will not get there. And it's not hiding. That is what we know in the open, that we don't know what is hidden. The former president was not hiding it, that he will never support Atiku under any guise.
Former President Goodluck Jonathan told Atiku Abubakar that if he wants to become president, he needs to make peace with Chief Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president. He made efforts to do that. Why did that seem to have failed?
Well, I think based on all the reasons we have conversed earlier, it's failed because, I think the very first time that he visited the outer farm of the former president, had relinquished his membership of the PDP. So he told the whole world then that he's no longer a politician. But I think I just visited as a friend and a brother, and he has advised him to seek for his blessing. But he's not a politician. This second one was written that he visited, that he needs his blessing and support. But then you can see that the former president is now romancing some party, EG, PDP, EG, ABC, EG, SGP, because he has some people there who are his lawyers, and you can see people migrating to those three parties now, saying that they will use one of these platforms to challenge the ruling APC. And Atiku is not in any of these parties.
So, what is the latest development concerning these recent defections, including Saraki, the Senate president? What is the significance of this, and what are the ramifications of some of these things happening in the Nigerian political landscape?
What I can say about the latest defection is that this is the season of defection. Season in the sense that this is the season where parties will be conducting their primaries. And some of them are defecting to realize their aspirations. And they have their local challenges in their various localities. For instance, in some areas, they have some understanding. They do some rotation. They rotate power. So if it is no longer your turn, if you have served a term or two terms, and they want you to vacate the seat. So what they normally do is to change their party to another party so that they can get the tickets of that party, thinking that they are very popular. So this is some of the reasons. You can just isolate some of them, like Bukola Saraki, like Sam Kalau, like the governor of Benue, and all the rest.
Abdurrahman Balogun is an assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. Hajia Asombi Bojang, mother of former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh, was buried after final funeral rites were performed Saturday. She was flown to the country from Equatorial Guinea, where she lived with the exiled former president. However, the former president did not accompany the body to the Gambia, where he faces a raft of accusations. Usainu Dabo, the Gambian vice president, represented the Gambian government at the burial. For more, I reach Omar Wali, an independent journalist in the Gambian capital, Banjul.
She went into exile with the former president in January 2017, but after she died after a brief illness last month on the 27th of July. And after a few days, the body was repatriated and it arrived yesterday and she was buried at Maghrib prayer.
I understand former President Yahya Jammeh could not, or the government would not allow him to accompany the corpse of the mother. What happened?
Yes, many people, especially his supporters, were expecting that he will accompany the mother to burial. But you may remember Jammeh is accused of many human rights violations, and from human rights to economic crime. So if he comes back to the country, he might be arrested. And the government also issued a press release before the body was released in Equatorial Guinea. They said if Jammeh will not be able to attend the funeral, and he will not escort the mother to the country. So that's what exactly happened.
On the other hand, I heard a lot of Gambians are praising the government for acting in a matured manner in the way it allowed the former president's mother to be buried without incident, although one of Jammeh's relatives was briefly arrested and released after questioning. Tell me, what happened?
Yes, that's what happened. The late mother was accompanied by some officials of the Equatorial Guinea government and one family member of Jammeh, who is currently living in exile with him. When he arrived, he was arrested and was briefly questioned and was released. He went back to Equatorial Guinea. However, you may remember in 2014, a former colleague, Jammeh loyalist, but later turned to be an opponent, Buba Balde, died outside the Gambia, but Jammeh denied him to be buried. And Kukwe Samba Sanyang, who was a rebel leader who staged a coup in 1981, who also died in exile, but he wasn't allowed to be buried in the Gambia. Another political opponent of Jammeh, Saleh Balde, also, Fode Makalo, rather, died in exile, but Jammeh did not allow any of them to be buried in this country. But the government, however, treated the case with maturity. The president delegated his vice president, Useni Dabo, to go and meet the family of the late president to pay condolences.
But has any Gambian heard from former President Yahya Jammeh about the death of the mother and subsequent burial that occurred Saturday?
Well, for now, publicly, no. But within the executive, they hear that he's communicating with those people. So as we speak, publicly, Jammeh is not communicating to the public, but his party executive is communicating with them, although he is yet to make any public announcement about the mother's death and burial in the country.
So how has the public reacted so far in the Gambia?
It has, the death of the old woman brought unity in the country. Politicians from different political parties came together, despite their political differences. They sat under the same roof to pay condolences to the former president's family, which was impossible in the former regime when Jammeh denied people to be buried here, when people cannot even pray for their loved ones who died under detention. But this government has gone beyond, has gone more than what the previous government has been doing, allowing them paying tribute and even facilitating the transportation of the mother to the Gambia.
Omar Wale is an independent Gambian journalist. He spoke with me from Banjul. Two jailed opposition activists in Zimbabwe will have to wait until Monday for bail hearings. The group faces allegations of inciting violence and causing malicious damage to ruling party property after the Movement for Democratic Change conducted protests Wednesday, resulting in at least 6 deaths. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The 22 opposition activists facing charges of inciting public violence and causing malicious damage to the ruling ZANU-PF party offices were told to return to court Monday for bail hearings after the court said it did not have enough time to hear their case. The charges follow a protest that claimed at least 6 lives after the army used live ammunition last Wednesday. The opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance was demonstrating against the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, which it accused of rigging the vote and holding the results of the July 30th polls. Gift Mutisi of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights said after Saturday's court proceedings, his clients had been trapped in the MDC offices after the Wednesday protests in Harare.
We made an application for refusal of placement on remand because we are saying the charges, they are not coming out from the facts. The alleged facts took place at the ZANU-PF head offices. These clients were not there. They were detained at the harvest house all along from the first to the second. The police officers blocked the entrance, so the clients also didn't want police officers to enter the building. So clients locked the gate.
While these protesters were in court, some MDC officials were attending the funeral of some of the people who were shot during the Wednesday protest. The opposition has indicated that it will follow all avenues possible for it to reclaim what it calls stolen votes, including more protests. The general election is the first one since the ousting of founding leader Robert Mugabe last November. Official results released on Friday indicate that incumbent Emmerson Mnangagwa beat challenger Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance. Mnangagwa got 50.8% to avoid a a runoff with the 40-year-old Chamisa. On Friday, Chamisa said he was contacting the head of the Southern African Development Community, Cyril Ramaphosa, who is also the president of South Africa, to discuss the issue. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa narrowly won the country's presidential poll, making him the first democratically elected president to succeed longtime leader President Robert Mugabe. However, as Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports, the victory may not be so sweet following contested polls and violence that left six people dead.
Incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won the ballot by 50.8% of the votes, giving him the legitimacy he sought after the November military intervention that forced the resignation of former President Robert Mugabe and ushered him into office. Professor Elliot Masocha of DeVry University says the outcome of the election expresses the will of the Zimbabwean people despite the rejection of the vote by the MTC Alliance leader Nelson Chamisa and his supporters.
That's the will of the people, and I don't know, you talked about some people saying it was not fair. Well, what I want to tell you and other Zimbabweans is that that's the character of opposition politics. They have to do that.
Not all concur with Masocha, however, given the questionable handling of the ballot and Wednesday's images of soldiers in the capital beating, arresting and shooting at MTC Alliance supporters, killing six. New York-based professor and analyst Dr. Wangu Mazotse says the way Mnangagwa got into office in November was not embraced by all, including opposition members, who wanted new leadership.
Mnangagwa didn't come through just a military intervention. To be precise, Mnangagwa came into power through a military coup. So the people gave him a benefit of doubt based on what he said. But the moment he showed that all what he was just saying was just an issue of words without any particular action or any sign that he was divorcing from the culture and the mentality of Mr. Mugabe, the people now expect, the least the people expected was just a free and fair election, which he has failed the test.
Executive Director Jeffrey Smith of Vanguard Africa concurs.
If you go through the litany of concerns, both in the lead-up to the election, during the election, and after the election, namely the violence, the brutality that we witnessed yesterday, indicates that the vote was deeply flawed, and it does not reflect the true will of Zimbabwean citizens.
Since his inauguration in November, Mr. Mnangagwa and his government have declared that Zimbabwe is open for business and had begun re-engaging the international community, which had isolated Mugabe. The U.S., which had imposed targeted sanctions on some Zimbabweans, is in the process of amending a controversial act known as ZITERA, the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act. But following Wednesday's violence, some like Steve Feinstein, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and an Associate Professor at Boise State University in Idaho, says the election victory has been overshadowed.
Mnangagwa's sort of roadshow ahead of time was really meant to try to persuade the international community and many others that this, it wasn't business as usual and that he represented a break from multiple decades of oppression President Robert Mugabe, as well as the ZANU-PF ruling party. I think a lot of us were skeptical. You know, we know the history of Mnangagwa and his allies, and that they really aren't in a position where they want to allow a free democratic process and fair elections to occur. They are merely trying to make a show that they're occurring while actually not willing to give up power when it comes down to it.
Dr. Masocha disagrees, saying one incident, while is regrettable, is not enough to undo Mnangagwa's gains.
So I think we are going to, Zimbabwe is going to have a good relationship with the international community. Things have been done in a better way than before. And that should count, you know, to the thoughts of the international community. They were there, some for the first time after a long time when they were not allowed to be there. So they have seen improvements, which they are not going to be biased. They have to acknowledge that there have been improvements in Zimbabwe. So, you know, democracy is a work in progress.
Independent analyst Leon Hartwell says while damage has been done on the part of Mnangagwa, he can turn the tables around.
But I do sense a lot of anger inside Zimbabwe. And I think it will be hard also for some of the Western governments to kind of justify moving forward with him. He's going to have to really show that he's genuinely interested in a peaceful Zimbabwe and to move forward.
It remains to be seen whether Mnangagwa will unite a divided nation following the killing of civilians by the military in Harare on Wednesday. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I am Kip Stube in Washington.
UN officials warn the deadly Ebola virus could be spread by refugees leaving the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu province. Officials are urging neighboring countries to increase surveillance at border crossings. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 100 armed groups are involved in long-standing conflicts in DR Congo's North Kivu province. Ongoing fighting and instability in the region are adding layers of complexity and difficulty to international efforts to combat an Ebola outbreak in the region. At least two decades of conflict has displaced more than 1 million of the province's 8 million inhabitants. Peter Salamo is World Health Organization Emergency Response Chief. He tells VOA an additional threat is posed by refugees. He warns some of those fleeing into neighboring Uganda, Tanzania, and Burundi may be taking the infection with them.
So not only do you have the problem of tracking that internal displacement, but then you have the potential exportation of infection across borders. And that's why we're already working with the government of Uganda particularly, but also Rwanda, which shares a border as well with Northern Kivu, to be fully prepared for any eventualities across the border.
The UN Refugee Agency is lending its expertise to this situation. It is preparing shelters for at least 1,000 vulnerable, internally displaced persons and other extremely vulnerable people in the Ebola-affected Beni area. It also is undertaking protection and monitoring activities. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahechich says his agency staff in Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania are on Ebola alert.
Specifically in Uganda, we have a continuous influx from the DRC. Our operation has intensified the awareness raising among the refugee and host communities. We have also increased the infection control and outbreak preparedness measures, and we also are preparing for entry screening, that would be the temperature checks for arriving Congolese refugees at the borders.
Mahechich says around 92,000 Congolese refugees have fled to Uganda so far this year. He says they are continuing to arrive at an average rate of between 100 and 200 a day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the world recently celebrated the 100th birthday of Nelson Mandela, a global political icon and Nobel Prize winner who was instrumental to end apartheid in South Africa. One of his grandsons, Indaba Mandela, continues to carry Nelson Mandela's message of peace, justice and solidarity, fueling the Nobel laureate's vision that one person can make a difference. Viewers Lenore Modu sat down with Indaba, who is the author of the book Going to the Mountain, founder and chairman of the Africa Rising Foundation and a UNAIDS global ambassador.
Indaba Mandela, welcome to the Voice of America.
Thank you very much.
When I say Nelson Mandela, give me three words.
Grandfather, courageous, fearless.
Can you elaborate a little more?
Courageous and fearless, obviously they go together. But, I mean, that is the man who went against the system, who sacrificed his family, sacrificed his own life for the greater good of his people. So for me, even if, when they isolated him in his later years as an old man to try and get him to denounce his political party and his fellow comrades, and they tried to, you know, persuade him with luxury and all kinds of things, he never waned. He always stayed focused on the dream that was at hand.
Nelson Mandela was one of the most visionary and influential political figures that the world has seen. You are his grandson, and you were the first child to grow up under his roof after he came out of prison. What was it like?
A bit overwhelming because I come from, you know, I was growing up in the ghetto with my parents, and it was a broken home by any standards. You know, moving in into this big house with security, drivers, so many staff. And the only two people that were really, it was me and him and then my cousin Rochelle. Me and my grandfather really didn't talk much. The only conversation we had was really, it revolved around my education, what I needed for school, and how was my report card, and the occasional scolding if my room was in a mess.
Interesting, because in your book, Going to the Mountain, I read about the time when he kicked you out you lost, for the second time, you lost your jersey.
Yes.
That was an example of the type of disciplinarian he was, right?
Exactly. You know, you think it is harsh, but he actually never let me sleep outside.
Yes.
But he made sure that, you know, he was serious. So he kind of exiled me outside for until it got dark, basically.
Yes.
And, you know, as harsh as it was, I never lost a jersey. So it was a very effective method.
The title of the book is Going to the Mountain. And it's a rite of passage for young men in your tribe.
Yes.
Now, something that I found interesting was the fact that you write in the book, your grandfather showed you that no ritual could make a boy a man. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, you know, there's a point where I didn't perform well at school. And my grandfather stopped me going to the bush. He is a person that really values education.
Absolutely.
Because it was something that that was stripped away from them.
Yes.
And even the college and the schools they went to, they were not on the same level as the schools that were being attended by white kids.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So that for him was a sort of a measuring litmus test to see whether you're ready to become a man or not, whether you are taking care of your responsibilities or not.
Yes.
And that can be judged from a young age. You don't have to wait till an adult.
And education was very important to him.
It was so important that he sent my parents to university at the age of 45 and decided to take me in because he felt that it doesn't matter how old you are, you need education. And that was 4 or 5 years after Nelson Mandela came out of prison. And he always said that it's important for you to get a degree. I didn't know what degree, and he never, ever pushed me to say, I want you to study politics or law or, you know, civil rights or anything like that. He just said, you need to have a degree. That is the most important thing.
Listen, there is an entire young generation of South Africans and even youth around the world that were born after Mandela came out of prison. they may not really understand the role that he played in the struggle. To what extent do you see them relating to his legacy?
That is the very reason why I wrote this book. I actually wanted young people to be able to see Nelson Mandela, not as this huge, great icon and this president of our country, but as a grandfather. Because young people can all relate to having a grandparent. Mm-hmm. You know, lessons from my grandfather. And that way, you know, I purposefully targeted the younger audience because I want the younger audience to understand the intrinsic value of Nelson Mandela and why is he important for the world. And okay. Of course, it's a 100-year celebration.
Absolutely.
And this is my way of paying tribute to a great leader, but my granddad.
And 100 years, indeed, in July marks the birthday. So what do you see as the common legacy that people should take from his life or perhaps that people are taking on their daily lives?
This is the first and foremost thing that they should take from Nelson Mandela, is what kind of leader was he? He was a man with a vision. He was a man who was dedicated and believed in his cause. A man who had integrity, humility. A man who dived into public service. A leader is there to understand his constituency and serve them the best way he can. You are there to be the voice and the face of those who cannot talk for themselves or act for themselves. That is what we must take away from this. Nelson Mandela, the leader, what kind of leadership? These are the characteristics that are important to be a leader.
Indaba Mandela is a grandson of Nelson Mandela. He spoke with my colleague Lenore Mudu in Washington. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Say your love will cost you something. Now you they do me something, something. You they do me like you gonna. I see the fire in your eyes, burning like a cigarette. Baby girl, are you from Ghana? Or are you coming from Somalia? Are you coming from Uganda? Or are you coming from Nigeria? African bag, baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are. The way you are. Feeling your dancing, girl. On the beat, you know. Yeah, feeling you're dancing. Yeah, Starboy, keep the beat. You know. Yeah. Them no bum me yesterday. Be a freaky girl and one. Oh. I put my hand upon your waist. Baby girl, you are the one. Oh, oh baby, you got to something. Give me all of your love, I want it. Baby girl, stop with all the fronting. The way you dance, I know you want this. Baby girl, you're from Angola. Sister from South Africa. Pretty girl, I wanna owe ya. Talk to my ladies in Nigeria. African bad girl. Baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are. The way you are. Feeling you're dancing, girl. Size on the beat. Make you dance. Say if you like conto, make you dance. Say if you like this or if you like that. Say if you like bounce, make you bounce. Say if you like galala, make you dance. Say if you like conto, make you dance. Say if you like this or if you like that. Say if you like bounce, make you bounce. I love the things you do to me. I feel alright. I love the feeling that I feel. I'm feeling nice. I love the things you do to me. I feel alright. Joe for me, I'ma get Joe for me. With your sexy body, with your sexy body, baby girl, please, baby girl, Joe for me. I'ma get Joe for me. With your sexy body, with your sexy body, African bag, baby, don't change your style, girl. I love you the way you are, the way you are. Feeling you're dancing, girl. Yeah, yeah. Stars on the beat, girl.
Tsa gwe mukwano guno Togo zanyi sa gwa tempola Oh Tokuita kuyomba na olava Banga iwe senga nkulize ani Tetuka Olayo mnange Obanga gamba Tife na yenga mkukozechi Nesi motu gantuge Neta wane nkaba choko tuse Atera obinda
Chona uchimani Naluli na kuoru goye Nenoto ndavye Echinoye kwewe Nota Nelwe sise tumumu baka Sista wange ya kukume Echino olemeo kutia Mujo Kube chizibu Nino kufuba No nyansimi Dwezine eneme Chukako Kale tonyiga Tokaba Ninda wikienja Sente zizo Nenze kumirimu Kulowoza konze kanzi chani sinde Kulabe kukatono ngende Jie Oh baby I got to go
Olutikolu lolu mese Nempewo ya komo se toneka Kuba wanonsiao Abankwana vajeo Na yeze na beresa
Mochejo
Selava numa
Emirimu anti jeminji
Bulichi sera Bankulinze Oba Bize Soka Otuse Atera ongenda
Shinge kwa gana mavumba Mkwanja manoti Ni kuonge vya thamani Ama Niwe fundo kuigiza kakanumba Masanja joti Usiwe mbali nani My darling I need you love Uwe na mi Haki ya Mungu na kupenda Nobody can show you love Usiwamini
ukisha wapa wanakwenda kwa basi jilegeze nikubebe mgongoni
yeleo
deka nikudekeze nikutunze kama moni
yeleo
wakija wapoteze ifanye kama uwaoni
yeleo
kisha uniongeze ulivofunzwa unyagoni
yeleo
oh baby asa dansi ni kone wabamijo ululu femi oh baby asa cheza ni kone wabamijo basi cheza na mimi moyo wangu waropa hini mchungu kiuziwa same mara sabini uo mzungu sajalewa kependa junga majini kwenye mfungu pareniwa kumbate baridini kwenye tundu kama njua moyo wangu nyoma kutu sini jena kibiriti
asawe
benzi likage ukachuki nyumba ikawa kibiti
asawe
nipatie vya kitandani nipe paka kwenye kiti
asawe
ile sininge shetani nawe kaja kukuchiti koba sijilegezi nikubebe mgongoni
yeleo
kitandani nikolezi kwa miuno ya kingoni
yeleo
kisha nibembeleze nirudisha utotoni
yeleo
weka mate niteleze kama nyoka pangoni
yeleo
oh baby asete nsikitoko oh wapanwecho ululu feni oh baby asa cheza ni kone wapamijo basi cheza na mimi ama nataka kucheza chura na ingali umesimama
ainama ainama
asa onyeshe
ainama ainama
unacheza
ainama ainama
unataka maji ya kisima na mwoga kututama
ainama ainama
embu onyeshe
ainama ainama
unachotaja
ainama ainama
unataka kupiga deki wima umesimama
ainama ainama
embu tuonyeshe
ainama ainama
unapigaje
ainama ainama
si unataka vya pool table sambona unajibana
ainama ainama
embu tuonyeshe
ainama ainama
unalengaje
ainama ainama
Oya wanangu wa kigogo
aina mani
pesa moze yobo
aina mani
funja funja kidogo
aina mani
aniongeze mikono
aina mani
gospel on the beat you ready now
say simple girl why are you so nice
Miami lady
gospel on the beat
I got the look, I got the sauce, I got the money and I got the swag. I got the look, baby, wine to the groove.
And if you give me love, then I give it to you.
I got the look, I got the sauce, I got the money and I got the swag. I got the look, baby, wine to the groove.
So baby girl, wine, ta-ta-ta, drop, ta-ta-ta, pull up in the club and why I wish. If you give me love, I'll give it to you.
If you give me
love, yeah. So baby, wine, ta-ta-ta, drop, ta-ta-ta, pull up in the club, I want your way, so.
Yeah, yeah.
If you give me love, I'ma give it to you. I love my life, oh.
Nobody can change that feeling.
Feeling, feeling,
yeah.
I love my girl, ooh.
Enough men they are with them lover. Your sand drinks all over. Ready to work with crazy hangover. Somebody please hold me. Because we want to release the beast on me. Somebody please hold me.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace, Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. After 24 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, the sensitive issue of land reform has not been tackled satisfactorily to all South Africans, particularly the overwhelming black population. The issue of land was discussed and debated during the negotiations leading to the end of apartheid, and the compromised position of willing seller and willing buyer has failed. And in the circumstances, it has become a political football in the political discourse among the political parties. The issue of land reform was central in the leadership contest within the ANC last year, and the Congress came out with a firm resolution for the nationalization of land in the footsteps of Julius Malema's program of land reform, which is now the central piece of his party, the Economic Fighters Group. Because of the forthcoming election, it is clear that unless this matter is handled, it may become the bane of many of the politicians. In the Big Six of the ANC, there is an overwhelming majority for nationalization of land without compensation. And even though President Cyril Ramaphosa may not be in favor of this radical move, he has no choice, because failure to support it may end with his being denied the possibility of the presidential flag. Consequently, last week, in a taped message, President Ramaphosa announced that the ANC would move with legislation in Parliament to change the South African Constitution to make it possible for the government to nationalize land without compensation. Obviously, this has annoyed the white community, particularly the White Farmer Association. But they do not have the votes in Parliament, and it's more than likely that the legislation will pass. What then for South Africa? If this matter is not handled properly, it may explode in the face of all South Africans to their detriment. It may result in white flights and capital flights, and the economic fortunes of South Africa may deteriorate. It has been concluded by all that the problem in Zimbabwe was the fact that former President Mugabe pushed a similar program, and since then the economic situation has deteriorated. But strangely, recently, the new president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has hinted that he would review the policy of Mugabe and may allow compensation to the white farmers, and some might be restored their land. So are we seeing a situation where the land problem is being solved in Zimbabwe when it begins to deteriorate in South Africa? The real issue is why the white farmers, not only in South Africa, but in Zimbabwe and Namibia, have not taken the lead to resolve this troubling problem. There is no way that one can proceed under the current conditions. So it is expected or hoped that white farmers and the government should begin immediately discussions as to how best to resolve this troubling issue before it becomes a political disaster in South Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Patrick Day, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, however far the stream flows, it never forgets its roots. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and a delegation from the President's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa announced over $1 billion in private sector deals during their recent mission to four sub-Saharan African nations. The Advisory Council members expect to quickly conclude more than $2 billion in additional deals in the coming days. The four-nation visit, which included stops in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Cote d'Ivoire, concluded in Ghana, where Secretary Ross signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the Minister of Finance to deepen the commercial partnership between the two nations. On previous stops, Undersecretary of Commerce Gilbert Kaplan signed a cooperative agreement with the Ethiopian and Kenyan governments. In Ghana, Secretary Ross led the U.S. delegation in meetings with President Nana Akufo-Addo, Vice President Mamoudou Bawumia, Minister of Trade Alan Karamatin, Minister of Energy Boaki Agyarko, and Minister of Finance Ken Ofori-Atta. Undersecretary Kaplan led the delegation in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Cote d'Ivoire, meeting with heads of state and senior government officials, including Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, President Alassane Ouattara, and Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly of Cote d'Ivoire, and Ethiopian Minister of Finance Abraham Tekesti. The delegation also met with business leaders and U.S. companies already doing business in those markets. The delegation also met with officials at the African Development Bank to better understand how and where the bank is providing financing throughout the continent. This financing is a key tool for U.S. companies as they seek procurement contracts. Cooperation agreements signed during the trip with Ethiopia, Kenya, and Ghana identify priority projects in key sectors to help achieve long-term growth and development. The cooperation agreements also establish a forum for the governments to address and resolve business climate challenges that limit participation by U.S. companies seeking to invest or do business in the three countries. The United States is making real progress in Africa, and we remain a strong, long-term, and stable partner in the continent's economic development, said Secretary Ross. We are finding solutions to transition aid-based economies to trade-based economies by creating new pathways for mutually beneficial long-term partnerships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.